Next case for argument is the United States v. Vila. Mr. Brindley.
May it please the court, my name is Beau Brindley and I represent the defendant appellant, Andrew Vila. The primary difference between the plea agreement at stake in Mr. Vila's case and those agreements referenced in the government's response brief is, I think, the fact that Mr. Vila's plea agreement can actually contain within it what amounted to an actual violation of a constitutional right. The constitutional right not to be subjected to an ex post facto law. And a defendant cannot knowingly and voluntarily waive a constitutional right that he does not know exists.
Why not?
Because I think it's logically impossible, Your Honor.
That's what the defendant argued in Brady against the United States, a very famous case, in which the defendant pleaded guilty in order to avoid the possibility of capital punishment. The year after he pleaded guilty, the Supreme Court held that the statute authorizing capital punishment was unconstitutional. And Brady then tried to get out of his plea agreement. He said, I couldn't have voluntarily waived a right that didn't even exist at the time. And the Supreme Court said, that's wrong. When you plead guilty, you give up the possibility of making particular arguments or claiming particular rights. And the fact that the law changes after the guilty plea does not affect its validity. Your argument seems to be, as best I understand it, seems to be the precise argument that the Supreme Court rejected 43 years ago in Brady. Do you have any way of getting around that case?
Your Honor, I don't think that the argument that we make is precisely the same as what you're referencing in Brady. In response to the question, I haven't looked at the language particularly of Brady on this issue, Judge.
Brady essentially takes the arguments in your brief and one right after another says no to them.
And, Judge, if the court wanted supplemental briefing based on Brady, Brady wasn't the case that the government was citing. We have not presented argument based on that, and I don't want to be arguing from a very particular set of language that I haven't reviewed. However, I think what we're looking at in this case is a situation where the plea agreement itself does in fact violate the constitutional right. It's there in the language of the plea. It isn't a situation where a right was created later. It's a situation where the right was being violated at the time.
I don't get it. Pew postdates the plea agreement.
It does.
Just as the Supreme Court's opinion in Jackson postdated the plea agreement in Brady. And just as the Supreme Court's double jeopardy decision postdated the plea agreement in Brochi, which is another case your brief doesn't mention, in which the Supreme Court held that a change of law after the plea agreement does not entitle the defendant to get out of the plea agreement.
And, Judge, once again, that's not a case argued by the government.
I understand that it hasn't been argued, but it's a decision of the Supreme Court. We have 2 9-0 decisions by the Supreme Court, spaced roughly 30 years apart, each saying that a plea is not rendered involuntary by a recognition of a new right after the plea has been made.
And, Judge, it is my position that this is not the recognition of a new right. This right existed at the time.
Look, the Double Jeopardy Clause was adopted in 1791.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree with that. But with respect to the Mr. Vela's entry of his guilty plea at the time that the Rule 11 colloquy was conducted, he was not given any advice about the problem with an ex post facto law. Now, I think it would have been better, as had been done by other counsel in other cases, knowing that the Pew case was in the pipeline, if an objection had been raised. That would have helped a lot for Mr. Vela. Counsel at that time did not do that, and that may be something that has to be pursued down the line through further litigation. But nonetheless, Mr. Vela received no advice from the district court during the colloquy that could have let him know that there was an issue that was alive in the Supreme Court at that time that said that he might be being subjected to an ex post facto law. And I think the fact that the case and controversy in Pew was actually being litigated and was known, I think should have been known to all parties at the time, I think that may change the situation, because we knew, or should have known, that this was an issue and he might be being subjected to a constitutional violation. And I think that's a difference that makes it, that it may matter in this case when doing this analysis. I think the government's argument with respect to waiver is similar to their argument with respect to the validity and the knowing and voluntary nature of the plea. With respect to what Mr. Vela was waiving, in their response brief, I think the government tried to characterize it basically as he was waiving the ability to challenge on appeal anything that involved the calculation of the sentence, and this is merely just a sentencing calculation issue, therefore the waiver covered. I don't think it is. I think when the sentencing calculation issue also constitutes and amounts to a constitutional violation, a violation of a constitutional right, then it is different. And the example that we gave in the reply brief that I think is worthwhile to consider is, had a district court, or this district court, said at the time of Mr. Vela's sentencing, "Mr. Vela, I would give you the statutory minimum sentence, but based on your race, I'm going to increase it." And then the government said, "Well, that's just sentencing calculation decision, and so he can't appeal that." I don't think anyone would agree with that. I think that would seem absurd, because a constitutional violation is more than just a sentencing calculation error. And I think when a sentencing calculation issue rises to that next level of also being a constitutional violation, in this case exposing a defendant to an ex post facto law, then the waiver cannot cover it, because it is in fact a constitutional violation and not merely a calculation alone. And I think that makes it different. I think that makes the waiver unenforceable with respect to this very specific appeal. Regarding the government's argument in terms of harmless error, the government's position seems to be that the judge would have given the same sentence anyway, because he gave him a reduction of two levels on the guidelines when coming up with his decision on what the sentence ought to be. So he gave him a below-guideline sentence. But that is not to say that Judge Shader didn't give serious consideration to the guideline range. And Judge Shader always does. And this transcript is no exception. He goes through in painstaking detail why certain guidelines apply here and how and why he has to consider them. So that is part of his consideration. And if Judge Shader had known that two of those levels could not be considered, then there's no way that the government can possibly prove that he would have given the same sentence, and so that the error here is harmless. That's just not establishable by the record that we have with respect to what Judge Shader said. In fact, Judge Shader talked about being limited in some ways by the way the consecutive sentencing worked together with the guidelines. And when you consider that, if he knows that there's a difference, the only way we can find out whether or not he would actually impose a similar sentence is to remand for resentencing, which we believe would be appropriate if the court does not vacate the guilty plea as being involuntary. There are no further questions. I'd reserve any remaining time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Friendly. Mr. Percanti.
May it please the court, Jeff Percanti on behalf of the United States. Mr. Vela entered into a valid and enforceable appellate waiver. That waiver contemplated that he would waive his right to appeal his sentence and how it was calculated. In return, the government made significant concessions. It agreed to dismiss a 5-year mandatory minimum count in a separate indictment, and it also agreed to recommend a sentence at the low end of the guideline range.
I'm interested in the exception to your appeal waiver. Mr. Brindley mentions it in his brief, but it seems doesn't emphasize it. But the exception, there's an exception. He's allowed to seek relief from, or there's an exception for seeking a reduction of sentence based directly on a change in the law that is applicable to the to defendant, and that prior to the filing of the defendant's request for relief has been expressly made retroactive by an act of Congress, the Supreme Court, or the United States Sentencing Commission. This is a change in the law, isn't it? In the circuit, at least, that the Supreme Court arrived at afterwards, that maybe, I mean, it doesn't have to be made expressly retroactive, but in effect is retroactive. Why wouldn't the exception here allow him to seek relief based upon the change in law that the Supreme Court announced?
So that exception contemplates collateral review, which is obvious based on the idea that it talks about a file.
It doesn't say it's limited to collateral review, does it?
It doesn't explicitly say that, Judge, but clearly the language...
Do you want us to read that in there?
No, I think it's tilted towards it. It would be nonsensical otherwise. I think that it says that it's a request for relief based on a development in the law that was made expressly retroactive, which Pew has not been made expressly retroactive, as this court has recognized, and was made retroactive at the time the request was made. And so while it doesn't say, you know, pursuant to 2255 or pursuant to statute, I think the reason for that is it leaves open whatever possibility there may be down the road for the defendant to seek a reduction in the sentence because of a new rule of constitutional or criminal law that is made expressly retroactive. But that isn't the case here. This is a pending appeal on direct appeal. While Pew has been decided, it has not been made expressly retroactive to defendants who were sentenced prior to the date, which I believe was June 15th or whenever it was decided, of last year. And so for that reason, the exception does not take this appeal outside of the scope of the appellate waiver. Instead, we're still within the scope of the waiver because what the defendant is really appealing is the district court miscalculated my sentence and I should be able to go back down to the district court and have it reimposed, which is explicitly covered by the appellate waiver. Now, if down the road the court were to make Pew retroactive, then perhaps this plea would allow Mr. Vella to file a 2255 or some other collateral relief document seeking to have his sentence reduced. But as of right now, he does not fall within the exception to that appellate waiver. The other point that I would like to address just briefly is the suggestion that because this is an ex post facto violation, that it's constitutional in nature, it somehow makes the appellate waiver unenforceable. We cited essentially three cases that I think are directly on point here: Lockwood, Bowens, and McGraw, that have been decided by this circuit.
Why didn't you cite Brady and Broachy?
Judge,
decisions of the Supreme Court. You'd think decisions of the Supreme Court would be the first place to go.
And Judge, I believe that those cases rely on those decisions, and they were certainly more recent. I think that Lockwood and Bowens are from 05 and involve Booker, and the McGraw case is from 09. And so I think those decisions are certainly based on those earlier precedents. We believe that these were so on point. And Lockwood and Bowens in particular, because they involve defendants who waived their right to appeal prior to Booker and then came before this court saying we could not have possibly waived our Booker rights to be violated, to be sentenced in violation of the Sixth Amendment because we didn't know about them at the time we entered into the plea. This court said that appellate waivers are not invalidated by a failure to anticipate subsequent legal developments and enforce both of those appellate waivers. I also would point out that both of those decisions expressly dealt with the race hypo that is raised in the defendant's brief and said, look, there is a baseline where if impermissible factors are used, both reference race specifically, where a sentence is imposed based on race, we of course would not enforce the appellate waiver. So the suggestion that example from the brief moves the defendant's position forward here at all is clearly foreclosed by Lockwood and Bones. And then McGraw has the same holding with respect to Begay, which was more of a statutory issue, but I referenced that case simply because of the impact that it had on the defendant's sentence. In the McGraw case, the fact that the defendant was being sentenced without the benefit of Begay led to a low-end sentence, a low-end of the guideline range that was 170 months higher than it otherwise would have been, and 212 months higher on the top end of the range, and yet this court still enforced the waiver on the same grounds that it enforced waivers and Lockwood and Bones. So the suggestion that he could not have waived his ex post facto right in this plea agreement simply because he didn't know about it is certainly foreclosed by this court's well-established precedent. With that, the defendant does not claim that there was any violation of Rule 11. In fact, he admits that the district court substantially complied with it. He also acknowledges that if the two-level enhancement at issue here was not in the plea agreement, which, by the way, had guidelines calculations that were not binding on either side and would not allow a party to get out of the plea agreement had the district court disagreed with those calculations, many of which were, of course, disputed anyway, that would somehow make he would change his plea. He has not committed to the idea that were this two-level enhancement not in the plea, he would not have changed his plea. And, of course, it's silly to suggest otherwise. Why would he agree to change his plea when he acknowledged before a district court he could face up to life imprisonment because of his plea and yet not plea because this two-level enhancement would not have been present? So if there are no further questions from the court, I would ask that the court dismiss this appeal or, in the alternative, affirm the defendant's sentence.
Thank you, Mr. Riccotti. Mr. Brindley?
To begin with the exception language that was contained in the appellate waiver in Mr. Vela's plea agreement, which we set forth in our initial brief, with respect to that, what I think is valuable to consider is that the Pugh decision as it stands right now applies to all defendants on direct appeal. Everybody in Mr. Vela's position who's appealing right now, and in fact, for example, the case United States versus Bostic, the government admits we need a resentencing based on this kind of an error. So everybody in Mr. Vela's position gets relief. It applies for all practical purposes retroactively to everybody else in his position. And so I think to suggest that that language doesn't apply to him rings hollow. With respect to the cases the government has cited regarding the failure to anticipate a change in the law, I do think it's a different situation when the government and defense counsel should have known that this was an issue now. Whether this law is going to change is coming. The court has this case. This case will be decided. And I think that makes it a very different kind of case, subjecting to a different kind of analysis, and I think that it should be, the plea should be invalidated and the case remanded, or at least remanded for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brindley. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.